I'm Peter Marks, theater critic of The Washington Post.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. I write for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Village Voice.
And I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the 14th episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America. We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group.
It's May, the lusty month of May. I just saw Camelot last night. And of course, to the rest of the country, that means talking about things like baseball or the plans for the summer. But in the theater world, we talk about the Tony Awards. The ceremony takes place on June 10th. And of course, theater journalists are up to our eyebrows in pre-Tony articles, features, previews, predictions, who will win, who should win, what can win, which song should be sung on the telecast, all that stuff.
What sweater will I wear?
Right.
Which slippers will I wear as I watch from my living room? And all this is completely inevitable, and it's not a bad thing, because this is pretty much the only time of the year when theater becomes a national conversation. Aside when Hamilton has some news about $4,000
tickets. Anything about Hamilton.
But that doesn't mean we have to play along, and we're not going to. We think that the Tony Awards bend the reality of theater in America far out of shape. For one thing, they cover Broadway and Broadway only. Off-Broadway productions get no awards unless they happen to transfer to Broadway, and shows elsewhere in America are fobbed off with a single prize, the Regional Theater Tony Award. The assumption is that you've got to travel to Manhattan to see great theater, and, you know, that's nonsense.
Yeah, and to make it – those are good points, Terry. And to make it really – so to drive home the ridiculousness, this year's Regional Theater Award is going to a New York theater company, an off-Broadway company, a very well-known one, La Mama Experimental Theater Club, known popularly as La Mama. And, of course, it deserves recognition. It's a wonderful incubator over many decades of theater in New York that led to other things in parts of the country. But by giving it to a New York-based company, the Regional Theater Award, you know, it really is screwing hundreds of companies elsewhere in the country that really are deserving and need the recognition, I dare say, way more. And this is the same thing that happened in 2014 with the Tony that went to New York's Signature Theater Company. Again, I don't think this is what the award was envisioned for. Do you?
No, not at all.
No. And one of the things is that the Tonys make it harder for many playgoers around the country to understand that Broadway is only a very, very small part of theater in America. And it's not even the most creative, maybe the most expensive, but it's right. Not the most creative or significant part of theater in America. It's just the most visible.
Right. That's right. So instead of doing the usual paint-by-numbers pre-Tony episode, we on Three on the Isle have decided to try something a little different. Very different, in fact. Different enough that we actually gave some thought to calling this episode of Three on the Isle
Fuck the Tonys!
But we're too genteel for that kind of thing.
Everybody knows that.
And the truth is, we don't really feel that kind of animus towards the Tonys.
Yeah, well, some of us don't.
Of course, Terry. So instead, we're going to call it, Is There an Alternative to the Tonys?
So it's going to be a bit of a thought experiment. And we all know, hear us doing the podcast, and I would gather people who listen to us, we all know that Broadway is not theater, and theater is not Broadway. But the Tonys are here, and they're hard to avoid. And they do serve a purpose.
That's right.
What we're wondering is this. Might there be some other way to serve the same purpose, but one that does a better job of serving theater, not just in New York, but throughout America?
One way to start grappling with this question is by asking another one. Why did the Tony Awards matter in the first place? And the answer is self-evident. They matter, first of all, because they're still on network television. Now that Time and Newsweek have pretty much stopped covering the lively arts, we really only have five major general interest publications: the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and the Los Angeles Times that make any serious attempt to cover theater beyond the city limits of the places where they're published.
So really what we're saying is that, you know, the only unifying thing we've got is the Tonys. And if you live outside of New York or Washington or Chicago and you want to know what's happening in American theater, what you do is once a year you watch the Tonys in the early, late spring, I guess it is, and see what the big shows are and you see what the numbers look like. And that's the best you can really do. Unless, of course, you subscribe to something like you're that involved and you love the, you read the trade press or you're, you know, reading the websites closely or even reading regional theater coverage elsewhere in America.
Or listening to Three on the Isle.
Or, of course, that's the new obsession.
Well, you know, the scary part about this is that the Tony's ratings are, they're not great. At this point, I mean, they've been on life support. It's for years.
Yeah.
They're minuscule. They drop every year. And, of course, a question is how long is CBS going to telecast the Tonys in primetime? And then what's going to happen when they decide that it's not worth their while anymore?
Right, that's the question. But for the moment, we do still have the Tony telecast, at least for now, and for what it's worth. And that's where I'd like to start the discussion rolling. So let me begin by asking both of you a question. What do the Tonys do wrong?
Where do we start with that one?
Yeah, where do we begin?
That's a big one. I think that one of the things that, of course, and we're gonna explain this in more detail and go through this, but one of the big problems with the Tonys is it is not, it pretends to be the best of American theater, and that is not what it is. It's really just a marketing tool for Broadway, and it's made less and less of attempt to recognize the best in American theater and just try to sell tickets. I mean, that's where we are with the Tony Awards, generally speaking.
Yeah, and to sell tickets to musicals above all, because we all remember time was when a very important part of the Tony telecasts were when you saw excerpts from the nominated plays, the straight plays. In fact, you go back to YouTube and look at those videos, and they become very important historical documents. Mm. You get a chance to really see what it was like to see James Earl Jones in Fences. That's the one I looked at most recently.
Mm.
This was a big deal, I think. It was a big deal for us now, historically. But in the moment, it mattered because it said plays are as important as musicals. And now the telecast sends the exact opposite message. There are musicals and everything else, devil take the hindmost.
Well, you know, actually, this is a kind of parenthesis and aside, but the fact that here, like by default, musicals are considered like the main thing. I was talking to some French friends recently and about being reviewing theater here, and this is, oh, okay, so you review theater, but do you also review musicals?
Oh!
For them, it's a completely different thing. And I said, well,
pull
actually,
that arrow out of my forehead.
In the U.S., it's considered, you know, it's one thing, and they just could not, like, that did not compute.
I don't think any of us are musical snobs.
No.
It's a wonderful medium. It's one of the most important contributions of that America has made to theater, the world's theater. But it's not the only thing that there is on Broadway, and I dare say, artistically, it ought not to be the most important thing, and the Tony Awards give a very different impression.
You know, sometimes part of me thinks that they should go, if we're talking about how to fix the telecast, specifically the telecast and make it more alluring. But like if you look at the Grammys, for instance, one of the things that's exciting about the Grammys is that they have those like collaborations that happen just one night. And sometimes part of me wonder if that wouldn't be fun to have like a special Tony's only scene or something that would not be part of a show, but that would be created just for that. Like, so you have the excitement that a duet between, I don't know, Elton John and Lady Gaga is going to have at the Grammys. That's going to be like that one time only. And I feel like sometimes theater has to kind of think out of the box in terms of improving the telecast and make it a must-see opportunity as opposed to just saying clips from this, excerpt from that. I'm not sure how to do that, and I'm not a producer, but I feel like for me that would be an incentive to get people watching.
Yes, I think so, very much so. That, and good heavens, you have all this talent, all these actors, all these creative people. If you can't come up with something surprising, you know, sell them down the river. That is just not good enough.
Well, they kind of do it as part of what the host does. You know, they're usually a skit or a number. They do that, but I think they could even push that further because, frankly, that's what a lot of people remember is, oh, that time, you know, Hugh Jackman did that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think they could have more of that and make use of the talent that's right there on site.
How might you change the telecast, Peter?
Well, one thing I was thinking as you guys were talking was the absurdity of that this year what will be proclaimed the best play in America, essentially for most people, will understand it to be Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, a two-part dramatization, basically, you know, extended fan fiction from England.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
You know, from Britain, and that's going to be cemented in people's heads as the theatrical, the dramatic event of the year, and there has to be this is ridiculous. I mean, and to have that, the pool of plays that they're choosing from is, I think, four others. I mean, seriously?
It's so sad.
I mean, so I guess I just have to, like, you know, I have to get out. I have to purge my fury over this before I can think about what would make it a better telecast. One thing that would certainly make it a better telecast from a theatergoer's point of view would be some kind of survey of American theater included in the show instead of a musical number from something that, you know, was on Broadway 5 years ago and they just throw it in because it's, you know, that producer is willing to pay for the number to be on the show. There has to be some commitment to that, and I dare say it's not going to happen with CBS telecasting this event, and maybe it's time for it to leave CBS
or to have a web-only component of the broadcast that does some of the things that we've been talking about, which I think brings us back to the problem of regional theater. If you're asking what are the best plays that were premiered in America last year, the answer is they probably didn't happen on Broadway. They almost certainly didn't happen on Broadway. But there are plays all over America, new plays. How are we going to find out about them? This would be a hell of a good way to find out about them on this telecast. Instead, you've got one award and it's going to La Mama. That really is thumbing the nose at where the center of creative action in American theater is. It's not Broadway. And I don't think, I don't remember the last time we've had a season that demonstrated that more powerfully than this one does.
Why is it, guys, why is it that the Drama Desk Awards, for example, can give an award for both Broadway and off-Broadway, can survey a much bigger landscape and recognize both those things in the same awards night, and the Tonys can't? I mean, I don't understand what is it? Do you think they have to like narrow down the number of judges, perhaps? Maybe it's, you know, giving it to 700 people who rarely can only come into New York a few times a year to see a few shows at a time is not the best way to be awarding awards for the Tonys.
Well, I'm going to venture that one of the reasons for the Drama Desk, for instance, so the Drama Desk Awards include Broadway and off-Broadway. And I've talked to someone who's one of the panelists or jurors, and that person said that the amount of work of seeing all these shows is just physically really hard. I mean, I would say about 220 shows a year.
How many?
And about 220.
Whoa.
220.
Well, you got me beat.
Me too.
But that's crazy.
We do not question your sanity, Elizabeth.
No, well, I do. but what I mean is that, and that would not be enough. Would not be enough. And so the issue is that, well, how do you do your job? I mean, even people who only vote for the Tonys, so just Broadway, some voters can't see them all. And by the way, I want to point out that this year they changed the system. Now it's an online voting, and you have to enter the date you saw a show. And if you have not seen a show, you cannot vote in that category, which can be a lot. Because
I'll
if
be
you
curious
seen,
to see how that affects
you,
response.
You both are
and
Tony voters?
I don't know how people are going to go around that.
I'm not voting. I mean, I don't see any point in it this year. And I don't, by the way, keep a record of what night I saw a show.
Elizabeth, you're a voter?
I'm a voter. But I do keep a spreadsheet. I have a spreadsheet and a very complete Google Calendar, so I can go back and see when I saw something. But it is insane. It's insane, and we're like, if you look at people who vote for the Academy Awards, the Emmys, mm-hmm. they get screeners. They can watch all that stuff right. in their living room in their slippers.
True.
We have to go out and see all that stuff. Again, I'm not complaining because we're not working in the coal mine, but you know, we have
we're
to
not?
Keep perspective there, but it's a lot of time.
Well, okay, here's a possible way of looking at it. How are the regional theater Tonys done? They're outsourced. The decision for who gets it is outsourced to a separate entity of drama critics who decide it in whatever way they want to do it. If you're going to increase, just looking at off-Broadway coverage, you can't do it the same way you do the actual Tony voting. And I think it's going to be eye-opening for them what the response is now that people have to supply all this extra information. But if you're going to add an off-Broadway component to the Tonys, then it's going to have to be done on some sort of panel basis. I don't see any other way to do it. And I actually think that might be a better way to do it.
Do you guys think that there are too many? Because one of the problems also with the off-Broadway awards is that there's so many of them. Do you think it would be a good idea to somehow streamline them?
Well, I don't know how you do it short of actual armed warfare, but it's clear that the combined effects of these numerous awards are diffuse because there are so many of them. And I don't know how you would get all of the people involved with the different awards into a room and saying, you know, how do you want to work this? This is a better way to work this. I mean, it may need to be something that is done by the Tonys for the Tonys if they want to add an off-Broadway component. And as for this regional theater thing, I mean, I think the first switch to throw is to disqualify companies based in New York from receiving the Regional Theater Tony Award. It makes no sense, especially if you're going to add an off-Broadway component, then there's absolutely no justification for it at all.
Yeah, I don't understand what the I don't understand where that shift occurred. By the way, we should tell listeners that, you know, we are going to come to a point in this podcast where we give out our own awards.
That's right.
So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, I think that the real issue here, and you know, is that that viewership is shrinking yearly. This is not a working formula anyway by the Tonys.
Right.
This is a shrinking resource of people who want to watch to begin with, and it really is probably a time when they should be thinking about a wholesale renovation of these awards. I don't know that I truly don't believe there's any impetus. There's nobody in the institutions that run these run the awards that has any interest in changing them. I just don't.
Yeah, because you know, every year right before the Tonys, the Broadway League announced their numbers for the season, and you know, this year the best season ever. Well, okay, so as far as they're concerned, everything is hunky-dory. Broadway's making a ton of money.
Well, sure. I mean, as long as you charge $1,000 a seat for the front row of Hamilton, your grosses will go up.
Springsteen, the man of the people, he's the one who's the new Hamilton this season.
Well, maybe what is needed is a completely separate entity. Maybe some foundation that has a serious interest in American theater ought to be saying, is there some sort of parallel award that we could underwrite, that we could organize, that would do the things that the Tonys are not doing? And that's the next question I want to ask you. In a perfect world where such a foundation took an interest in this process, what ought to be done that is not being done by the Tonys? Exactly what? I mean, we've clearly said Off-Broadway is something, a problem that's got to be solved. What are the other problems that have to be solved?
Well, one of its, you know, one of the problems is, you know, is at a fundamental institutional level. It's the promotion and recognition of new work all over the country, and some mechanism by which we allow people a clearer, a more of an illumination of what's going on everywhere in the country. It's a big country, but we certainly have the resources to narrow down, to 15 or 20 of the great works that are the really exceptional work that's being done around the country, by a panel of people who are seeing most of the work. I don't see why that can't somehow be accomplished. Through some kind of clearinghouse organization.
Well, something I discovered when I got on the road is that every major city or catchment area, South Florida has one, that has a lot of theater, has its own local Tonys. They have their own awards given yearly by such critics as still survive. And a great deal of attention in the areas is paid to these. They're already doing the screening, in a sense. You already have awards in Chicago, awards in South Florida. You've got them in Washington, D.C. I know, Peter.
Right.
Why not incorporate these into some kind of larger process whose purpose is to draw attention to the fact that it's a big country with theater going on everywhere else?
So you think about something that will be like once a year, some kind of, because at the same time, so you have those regional awards, but you also have things like a lot of financial awards. I mean, actually going from like the Pulitzer for drama all the way to, you have the Relentless Award, you have the Lily Awards, you have tons of them. And so as an aggregate, you could argue that they're giving you a kind of snapshot of the state of playwriting, for instance, in America. Would that help? Is that what you are aiming for? Some kind of a snapshot, like once a year, of this is...
Yes.
American theater.
With particular reference to new plays, because I think that's the thing where the Tonys are falling
right
down most acutely. And that's something that you can put your finger on. I mean, new plays, if that's what you're looking to recognize, don't do it in June. Do it at the end of the summer or in January. I mean, there are a lot of different ways that you can approach this. But get out of that gangbuster area where everything's happening at the same time and say, all right, we're going to create some sort of new broadcast, some sort of new award whose purpose is to recognize theatrical activity all over the United States with specific reference to new work, and to try to give it the kind of weight that will make people pay attention to it.
And maybe it doesn't have to be a competition. You know, maybe we all get hung up on, you know, this best of, you know, I know it's a human impulse to want to pick the best, and oh my God, we love to watch people lose as much as we love to watch them win. But I wonder if we just should be thinking about it in a new way. You know, there's got to be some mechanism by which you can present, you know, 5 or 10 of the best works being done in America now. I wish I had the producing skill to figure out what that program would look like. But it just seems to me that, you know, that would be sort of a valuable thing. I would love to know what's going on elsewhere in the country, and I would love to see who those voices, who those people are who are writing those plays. Maybe, though, you know, maybe my interest is just way too involved, you know.
It was really an eye-opener to me when we had Lauren Gunderson on this show, and all of us suddenly realized a playwright with whose work we are comparatively unfamiliar is the most widely performed playwright in the United States. If that doesn't make you sit up and say there's something wrong with the process, I don't know what will.
No, it's very true. But the thing with Broadway also is just, especially this year, the weakness of the plays this year, the play field, the
right.
playing field, is so depressing because the pipeline did not work. The pipeline, by that I mean, you know, regional theater to Broadway or regional to off-Broadway to Broadway. That kind of thing that usually feeds... Actually, even sadder is the fact that plays don't go straight to Broadway anymore. I think Dos House Part... I always want to say Dos House Part 2 last year was an exception that I don't think it had any run off Broadway or regional. I think it went straight to Broadway. It is so rare, so incredibly rare...
That's right.
...for this to happen now that is... It's just... It's striking.
You know, I've been... Go on, Peter.
I just wonder, do you think... Anymore, it's true that watching the Tony Awards makes anybody interested in becoming a theater goer? I mean, is that really, you know, I remember watching as a kid and, you know, it filled me up because it was that world that I wanted to know more about and see more of and understand more. But do you think that has that conversion ability anymore, or is that gone forever?
No, I think it could. I really think there are kids, as a faithful viewer of the short-lived TV series Rise, I'm going to venture that some of the kids who are watching Rise would watch the Tonys and think, this is what I want to do. Mm. And a good Tony number can be great. I mean, do you remember when Bernadette Peters did that number from Gypsy, how great it was, and it was just her.
Right.
And I think you can still have that great number once in a while that comes in, and you're just like, oh my God, what the hell was that?
All
so good.
All the more reason for including scenes from straight plays, because if we're not feeding that impulse, and we're only feeding the musical impulse, we are disserving theater as a whole. I've been pushing behind the scenes for the last, I guess, 10 years now, for somebody out there to underwrite a series of telecasts of performances by regional theaters.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I've actually written about. I mean, they wouldn't even necessarily have to be shown on PBS, which is increasingly indifferent to this kind of thing. You know, they could be made available through other media. They could be made available on the web. They could be made available in the same way that screeners are. But every serious company that wants to become known beyond its own city limits, the most powerful thing that they could do is to tape their best production of the season and make it available for viewing, for distribution. And this could certainly become the basis for a telecast that I think could transform the position of regional theater in the theatrical food chain in America.
Well, you know, actually, in October, there's a new streaming channel that's going to launch dedicated to theater. And I wonder if one of the things they would do would include just what you said, because that seems to me that it would be an obvious... I mean, right now, there's one called Broadway HD, which is quite good. They have good stuff, but it's pretty... Big stuff. But this new one that's coming out in October, I can't remember their name, but it's going to launch, and they're going to have also a kind of talk show. They're going to have like a whole bunch of programming. And one of the things that they want to do is, I think it would be a great opportunity for them to, it's called Stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty serious. I should have remembered that. So Stage is launching in October, I believe. And I would love it if they did exactly what you just said, carrying telecasts of regional productions.
Right. There has to be a funding stream. You have to deal with the union issues. But it can be done. Although, I'll tell you something that is becoming clear to me from this discussion is that...
You know,
go on.
I was going to say, you know... The quality of, if you guys have gone to NT Live or any of the film, the theater on film that is now becoming immensely popular in this country, you know that the camera work is much more sophisticated than it was. It's not the one, you know, stationary camera filming a play and making it look like, you know, homework. It actually looks dynamic if you shoot it from different angles. There is no reason that theaters could not film their, have, bring in companies to film their plays in this, in these formats and produce them for a Tony, telecast, as you're describing, Terry, and making those dynamic evocations of these productions. There is no excuse for that not happening.
Well, I think one thing that's becoming clear to me as a result of this discussion is that we're probably stuck with the Tonys as they are, and that they can probably only be changed on the margins, if at all. And what we seem to be groping towards is that there needs to be some second national form of recognition for theater all the way across America. So to that end, we're going to spend some time in this podcast presenting our very own Three on the Isle Anti-Tony Awards for 2017. I guess we could call them the F*** the Tony Awards, recognizing achievement in five major categories with eligibility not restricted in any way. If it happened on an American stage in the last season and it was new, it is eligible for an anti-Tony. So with that in mind, let's...
The most generous eligibility.
I like to think so. So let's start with the category that I have called Best Acting Performance in a Play or a Musical. Peter, what's your pick? Tell us about it.
Well, if I had to narrow down all of the performances I've seen in the approximately 140 shows I've seen in the last year, I would pick Billy Piper as Yerma in the production of Yerma at Park Avenue Armory in New York. This was, for me, pound for pound, the most extraordinary acting 2 hours of, or an hour and a half of whatever it was of acting of anything I saw anywhere. And the technical as well as emotional power of what Billy Piper does in this adaptation of a 1930s Garcia Lorca play is extraordinary by any measure.
Elizabeth, what about you?
That was one of my choices as well. So I would have said Billy Piper as enthusiastically second that, and I cannot wait to see her again. I hope she comes back and do another play here. My choice would be Maureen Ireland in Summer and Smoke by Tennessee Williams, a revival by the Transport Group of Broadway. Transport Group, a wonderful company. We welcome Jack Cummings III, the artistic director, in our previous podcast. And Maureen Ireland is one of the treasures of the New York stage. I just pretty much every time she's in a show, I'm always looking forward to it. But I don't think I had ever seen her in a kind of classic performance, in a classic text. She always felt very like a very contemporary actress to me. But she can absolutely do Williams. She really, and I was also sitting very close to the stage, so I could see her in super close up, super HD. And it was just a really frighteningly intense. And just, oh my God. Actually, not dissimilar to Billy Piper's performance in this kind of just super highly sensitive performance where you just actually feel for the actor's sanity in a way. You just hope they're okay at the end of the show because it cannot be easy to do that every night, like 8 times a week or however God, many times no. they do it. I can't even imagine. So
we should mention that this production, this revival of Summer and Smoke, is a collaboration between Transport mm-hmm. Group and Classic Stage
yes.
Company, one of New York's
mm-hmm.
top off-Broadway companies.
Yes.
Well, since we've been running Broadway down, I'm going to take us back there for my pick and to choose a performance that was not flamboyant, not in your face, the kind of subtle, low-keyed, quiet acting that I have a special love for, and that is the performance of Brian Tyree Henry in the Second Stage's revival and the Broadway premiere of Kenneth Lonergan's play Lobby Hero, a tightly wrought, small-scale ensemble piece in which this is an actor and a role in which very gradually something is revealed, this moral conflict that drives this man's life, and it is threatening to sunder it. And there's no shouting. Nothing gets thrown around. Nobody's in your face. It's just this guy up here on stage making it clear in a very subdued, low-keyed way that his life has just been turned inside out. That was a wonderful performance of a wonderful role in a wonderful
Totally.
I agree on that one, too.
Let's move to best revival of a musical. And here our choices range geographically quite widely. Peter, start with you again.
Well, you know, I've rethought my original thoughts on what I thought the best revival of a musical were, because I also thought about what was the best reinterpretation of a musical. And I'm going to surprise you, perhaps, and I'm going to say that the best musical revival I saw the last year was Once on This Island, at Circle in the Square.
Wow.
Yeah. I do think it. Aarons and Flaherty wrote this many years based on a myth, and it's quite a moving production, and Michael Arden, the director, I think really brought out the emotionality of this piece and did it with a number of performances that are pretty extraordinary and went unrecognized at the Tonys, I think. I don't think any performer from, except for, the young woman who plays Timon was nominated. But I thought that it really made the case for that show in a way that almost no other revival did quite as well this year.
Elizabeth?
I'm going to double down on My Fair Lady, actually. I've already mentioned it in a previous podcast, but I thought this was a lovely, lovely revival and very illuminating of a musical that up until then, I only kind of liked, where I could see what was good about it, because obviously the score is beautiful, but I could never really get into it. And on this Lincoln Center revival, directed as usual by Bartlett Sher, I felt they really solved the problem of My Fair Lady. That said, I hope maybe Lincoln Center kind of moves away from reviving those great classics, or maybe try something new, because I feel they are getting on this path now that
and somebody new, yeah.
That may not be healthy for them creatively. That said, if this is their last one, I could not be happier.
Well, I'm going to take you out of town for mine, which also might be a model for something that Lincoln Center could try. I went up to Boston, to Huntington Stage, to see the great problem musical, Merrily We Roll Along. Mm. Maria Friedman brought her London production over to Boston. It was the best staging of Merrily that I've ever seen, and I've seen some good ones. And it wasn't, you didn't feel that you were seeing a problem being solved. You felt that you were seeing a great show made manifest for the first time, with a fabulous cast, with energy, originality, simplicity, which so often is the key to making Sondheim shows work. I was betting money that this, not actual cash, but that this production would come to New York. And I still hope that it does, because Maria Friedman, who is, of course, best known as a performer, not as a director, has, I think, unequivocally established herself as the real deal when it comes to musical comedy direction. So I'm hoping that we see more of this wonderful, wonderful show at some point.
You've made me want to see it, Terry. That you know, it sounds kind of. I mean, I've always felt like there's always a better Merrily waiting to happen.
Yeah. Well, this one. Well, I was thrilled, absolutely thrilled. Let's move on to our next category, which is best revival of a play or classical production. Peter?
Well, I'm going out of town with this one, and I am picking a production that I didn't expect to be on my list at all, because it also is one of those plays that we spoke about in another episode of things we never want to have to see again. It was a production of Twelfth Night at Shakespeare Theater Company, directed by Ethan McSweeney, who's a terrific interpreter of the classics. And he said it, of all places, dare I say it, in an airport waiting lounge. There was an amazing effect. The shipwreck scene, which is the crucial sort of linchpin of the play, the effect was stunning, and it was done as an airplane crash. And boy, in Sydney Harmon Hall, did that reverberate as a wonderful way to modernize the play. And it was just one of those productions which was completely in balance between sort of the light comedy and the cruel comedy, and it reignited my appreciation of a play that I thought I'd seen enough of.
You can't say better than that, Elizabeth.
Well, I'm going to go with another Shakespeare, and it was Richard III at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It was directed by Thomas Ostermeyer. It was a German production from the Schaubühne in Berlin. And it was just high octane insanity. It
brilliant.
Was so creepy and fun, and it was just a fantastic, propulsive. There was a great live drummer. It sounds like a carnival, but it's really, the effect was not as cheesy as this may sound. It really got to the core of the play. And actually, what's interesting is Ostermeyer came back a few months later to New York with a completely different production of a new play called Returning to Rest. Very quiet, subtle, completely opposite. He's not a one-trick pony director. He does not necessarily go for flash. He's very, very good at tailoring his effects to what he needs to say. But that Richard III was absolutely incredible.
Wow. Well, I don't go in for ties, but I'm afraid that I have one. I really have to. One
after all the votes were counted?
That's right. One is a modern revival and one is a classical production, and they're both out of town. I went to People's Light, which is a theater company in the suburbs of Philadelphia that I've had my eye on for some time, because they revived a 1939 play that I have never seen and always wanted to, Paul Osborne's Mornings at Seven, which has had high-profile revivals in 1980, again in 2000 in Lincoln Center Theater, but has never really established itself as a play with a revival life, although I'd heard so much about it. And it was one of the most beautiful productions I've ever seen done by, it's a play about older people, and it was done by the veterans of the company, of People's Light, which is has a sort of a semi-permanent ensemble. And it just took my breath away. The play was as good as I had hoped it would be, but the production would have given life to a play that was much less satisfying. It was directed by Abigail Adams, who's the company's artistic director, and had I not seen another show that was that good, it would have absolutely been my pick. But I also, last summer, saw a production of Pericles, directed by Eric Tucker of Bedlam Theater, at American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Eric is known for small-scale productions done in what are politely known as toilets. And this one was done in American Players Theater's outdoor amphitheater, a huge space. It was the first time I'd ever seen Eric work on a large scale. And it was just a riot of imagination and joy and surprise. And it confirmed me in my feeling that he is a director who can really do just about anything.
Mm.
Was that the men's stage toilet or the smaller?
I guess we use that term more in jazz when people talk about, oh, yeah, I had to play a toilet last week. Let's talk.
Toilet playhouse for you.
Right. Mister. Well, we've been talking about new plays and the necessity for drawing attention to them. Let's pick our favorite best new play of the season just passed. Peter.
Well, talk about unlikely places to find the best work. I found the best new play that I'd seen this year in West Virginia, and and not because that's so far fetched. There's actually a wonderful summer festival of new plays there every summer called the Contemporary American Theater Festival. It expanded last summer to 6 productions from 5. It's been run for years by a guy named Ed Herendeen, who is a complete apostle of new plays. And this one was called The Niceties. It was a 2-character play and had, you know, the most, humble of premises. A student of mixed race submits at a very good school, submits a paper for a history class to her very liberal professor, and an explosion occurs between them of wills and thoughts, and all revolving around slavery in the Revolution, and whether or not that discredits the founding fathers as moral heroes. And by the end of the play, there is careers are in tatters and lives are shattered, and it just exhausted me emotionally, and I just thought it was the microcosm of America that we're seeing played out every day, and I just hope it gets done in New York and elsewhere.
That sounds like a play with the future.
It is
legs.
Actually coming to a Manhattan Theater Club.
Really?
This coming season, yes.
Excellent.
Yes,
excellent. Yes. Your pick, Elizabeth.
Well, my pick was off-Broadway, and it was the Amy Herzog play Mary Jane at New York Theater Workshop, in a wonderful production by Ann Kaufman, who's really one of my favorite directors working in New York right now.
Oh, me
or
too.
Everywhere. She's
me too.
Traveling, but she's wonderful. And that play starred the brilliant Carrie Coon in actually one of these subtle performances that you were talking about earlier, Terry. This is a very unshowy performance, very affecting. It's about a mother, single mother of a very severely, I would say, disabled. Did you say this? A severely sick child who needs constant care. And we never see the child. It's all about the mother and her resilience and good humor in the face of this situation. And the support and help and she gets from actually all women around her. The cast is entirely female. Without making a point about it. Actually,
no, that's
it's very
part of
matter of fact.
What was so good about it, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a point play. It's not a play making a point about anything other than just life and hardship and enduring. And it's a play that is very modest in scope, but very big in ambition without being show-offy about it. It's absolutely lovely. And I think it's my favorite Amy Herzog play so far. I quite like 4,000 Miles. But this one, she really completely captures something very, very difficult to capture, which is this fleeting emotion and just the hardship of life, but the fact that you can also find such good in it. This woman has such a hard situation, and she's so, with that being Pollyanna-ish about it. It's an absolutely lovely play. It should be on Broadway. That's exactly the kind of play that could be, should be on Broadway. Why it's not there?
Right.
I mean, I can't even.
Yeah, well, you know the answer to that. Well, I will keep things simple because my pick is also Mary Jane, which I happened to see twice. I saw the premiere at Yale Rep, in which the title role was played by a wonderful actor named Emily Donahoe, who was recast with Carrie Coon in New York. They were equally good performances of a different color, a different emotional color, but they were equally wonderful. And the play was slightly revised between the two runs, entirely to good effect. So it really gave me a chance to see Amy Herzog's craftsmanship at work. I got on her bandwagon with 4,000 Miles and then sought out a regional production of After the Revolution. And I have thought since then that she is very much the real deal. But I did feel that this play took a step forward for her. And to anybody who knows anything about the stresses of caregiving, this is a play that, of course, she has personal knowledge of this herself. And, it's emotionally powerful. And it, made me cry.
There's probably a good podcast segment in this issue of what makes us cry and how that affects critics.
Yes.
I think it's an interesting issue, whether you trust your tears or not. I also found this, by the way, I found this a great play, too. It's also interesting to note that both Amy and her husband, Sam Gold, dealt with the issues of a child with who's struggling on stages in the last 2 years in New York. Sam doing it in his version of The Glass Menagerie.
Right.
And the other thing I think we should also note, it's interesting that even from our varied perspectives, the directors of both these plays were women, Kimberly Senior and Ann Kaufman, and both plays are by women. Then we've sort of, unconsciously, I think, inadvertently picked up on another important theme that's running through our lives right now.
I think, if I remember correctly, the design team for this production was also entirely female. And yet, again, it was not something that was thrust in your face. They just did it.
It just happened.
It was great. Which brings us to our last category. The big action at the Tonys goes to Best New Musical, but ours will be coming out of a different pocket. So for the best new musical, Peter.
Oh yeah, Peter. That's a
you really are coming out from,
well,
from left field.
It was a tie in my sentiments for Bruce Springsteen on Broadway, but I was persuaded that is really a concert. So I went to another show that moved me with music, and we all agreed, by the way, that The Band's Visit couldn't win in this category because it was from last year at the Atlantic Theater Company. Correct.
Yeah, otherwise it probably would have swept the category.
Yeah.
That Sponge thing.
So, yeah, right, Sponge.
So I picked the Worcester Group's The B-Side, Negro Folklore from Texas State Prisons, which is a wonderful, it was a ravishing little production in which the actors sang along with a recording of this amazing album of men on the state farms in Texas who sang songs of their suffering, basically, to get through their days on these prison farms. And it was enlightening, illuminating, and moving in all the ways that you want music on a stage to affect you.
It sounds wonderful. Elizabeth?
My pick is K-pop, which was a musical about the musical genre known as K-pop, Korean pop. And that was a co-production of Ars Nova and the Wuchet Collective at ART New York. I hear there's a rumor that they're going to try to bring it back next season. And I hope they do, because they spent so much energy. That thing was on two or three floors. You were going from room to room. So the amount of energy and time that they spent completely customizing the space for a 3-week run, something like that. And it was a very, very funny, energetic production. They really captured that kind of insane giddiness of K-pop. And at the center, a lot of great performances, but I will single out Ashley Park, who's emerged as one of my favorite musical theater performers right now. She's in Mean Girls. She's playing one of the trio of Mean Girls. She was also wonderful in the Lincoln Center revival of The King and I. She was playing Top Tin.
That's right. I'd forgotten that.
Yes, that is her. She is so versatile. I foresee a very bright future for Ms. Ashley Park. And she played a K-pop diva in K-pop. Very biting and funny. She's so... You know, she has a mix of incredible technique, but that does not feel robotic.
Ooh, say that word again. I love that.
Technique or robotic? Oh,
technique. Beautiful.
But anyway, so yes, that's my choice, K-pop.
Well, I don't need to say much about my choice, Miss You Like Hell, because Aaron McKeown, who wrote the score, was our guest a few weeks ago. It is, of course, a you could say, in a sense, a rock and roll musical about the relationship between a mother and her daughter. It was extraordinarily well staged and performed. But what I want to stress here is the route by which it made its way to us. It premiered in development at La Jolla Playhouse in California and then made its way to the Public Theater in New York. Like your two picks, it is not a Broadway show. It is not a large-scale show. It has taken another route to public attention. And I think for those of us who really care about the artistic health of the American musical, this route and the small scale of these shows is going to be where the creative action is in the foreseeable future. About which we could go on and on, but the clock has run out on episode 14. We will be back with another podcast, but until then, I am Terry Teachout of the Wall Street Journal.
I'm Peter Marks of the Washington Post.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. You've been listening to Three on the Isle, a twice-monthly podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is the inexhaustible Kirby Pate. You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle and write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com, spelling out Three on the Isle.
Let us know what you think, especially if you have any suggestions about the those non-Tony Tonys. And tell us what you would like to hear on future podcasts. And make sure you leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or Google Play.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next time on the Isle.